Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Because it's time. It's time for reparations.
The only thing I have in common with this character is that she's black. This does not look like me or sound like
me. I'm sick of being a side Indian character.
It's like, it's a form of cultural imperialism.
How are you supposed to feel that exploitation is the best you can get?
LGBTIQ rights are black rights. We have always been here. Black queers, we will always be here.
This is Amir Rahman.
I'm Francesca Ramsey.
I'm Gary Foley.
And you're listening to The Race Card.
Welcome to The Race Card. I'm your host, Amina Ziyard, and joining me in studio today is my co-host, Ahmed Yusuf.
Hey!
So before we begin, we'd like to do an acknowledgement of country. We acknowledge the Kulin people as the owners of the land on which we meet, and we pay respects to their elders, past, present, and future. This land was never ceded, and the processes of colonization, occupation, incarceration, and genocide that began over two centuries ago continue to this day. We have Bhakti Puvanantharan in studio today, and we look at what we have in the bin this week and a featured story on homelessness and the housing crisis.
What's going on, people? This is Akala, and right now you're listening to The Race Card. Big up.
So today in studio, we've got Bhakti Puvanantharan. Welcome to The Race Card.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a joy.
I know. I've been like looking forward to having this interview because you are someone I look up to. I feel like the first time I met you, I think I was like fangirling a little bit. I try to keep it down. But yeah, that's just how I feel.
Right back at you, Amina.
Bhakti, I guess, how did you get into writing and I guess journalism in more broadly?
So I started at uni. I would say I didn't really know what I wanted to do. More honestly, I didn't know whether I wanted to be a lawyer or a journalist. So that's why I could do a double degree back then. So I did a double degree in law and journalism. And I thought I would probably do more broadcast. But I also have always loved writing and always enjoyed reading. And so when I got to uni, I met... One of my tutors was actually editor of Farrago, which is Melbourne Uni's magazine. He encouraged me to submit. He had previously been an editor and then he kind of went on to be a journalism tutor. And so I started writing for them and then I edited Farrago and I kind of just went from there. I just fell into this community of writers at Melbourne Uni.
Because you initially started as a broadcaster. I think you did stuff with Sin and 3CR and Triple R.
That's right, yeah. So I started, actually the first one was 3CR. It was a community thing. So I'm Tamil and the Tamil community has a couple of shows on 3CR. One's Tamil language. My Tamil's not that good. So I did the English language show, which was called the IAO show. And it was kind of aimed at young people. And we talked a lot about the Tamil people's struggle. And yeah.
I guess like, because you've been doing broadcasts and you're doing writing, I guess, what was it like choosing or trying to figure out which one you wanted to do?
I mean, I didn't really get a choice. It was just whatever opportunities were there, and I pursued both as voraciously as I could. I was writing freelance as well as doing, you know, unpaid work for community radio stations because I love community radio, but also because, you know, I wanted to upskill and keep learning. Yeah.
So you mentioned that you were doing a double degree in, was it journalism and law?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So how did your parents kind of take... the idea that you were going to become a writer and editor, was there any kind of, you know, how do we say, like, any
backlash
maybe? Like, yeah.
So my dad thinks that I did journalism because I want to be famous, which is not true, because I just don't think that that's a viable
like I would think that you'd be doing acting if you want to be famous,
right.
Or music.
Yeah, correct. There's a, yeah, I mean, you have a, I mean... Leaving Twitter aside, you're pretty much anonymous when you're a journalist, right? But I think my parents were really, really good about it because they saw how hard I was working. And, you know, my mum's policy has always been you can do whatever you want as long as you're the best at it, which is a lot of pressure. But, you know, it's always been something they've been proud of me for doing.
What's that pressure like?
I don't really think about it very much. It's probably that message when I was a child is probably how I now put pressure on myself to be the best I can be and to keep striving.
So when you said that you were voraciously pursuing these, you know, two areas, was there an element of trying to prove to your parents that you were doing the right thing? I'm sorry, I don't mean to say like all people of color's parents are this way, but like I'm just curious because I feel that's what I'm doing right now with my parents, trying to justify what I'm doing is like the good thing for me. Or was that not an issue?
I think there were times when they would question, like, where is this going and how are you going to make money and how are you going to provide for yourself? And I think, you know, my response to that was, well, you know, I worry about those things too, and that is why I'm doing it. I don't think I necessarily did it to prove it to them, but to prove to myself, you know, that a career in the media was at least viable for me. Yeah.
What was that like? Because, like, I know, like I mean, it's similar. Like, I was like to me, Ahmed, you're doing all this radio and podcast stuff. Like, but are you making any money? Like, what's that like trying to, I guess, climb that ladder?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, for me, like, my mum loves the radio. We grew up listening to the ABC. So for her, like, if when I talk about radio, she knows what I'm talking about and she has a point of reference, I guess, especially when I started getting, you know, I had casual work at the ABC sometimes, and that for her, I think that legitimized my career. So, you know, yeah, on the other hand, I did lots of unpaid work, and I think, especially because I was talking about the Tamil community, they really supported that as well. So it was, you know, it wasn't just about work. It was meaningful to them as migrants. And for you guys, you know, you're doing a show about race. So, I mean, it's a similar project.
You talked about, like, unpaid work there. Like, how does that make you feel, like, having to work but not get paid? Is there some sort of frustration there when you were doing that?
Well, so my theory is, you know, if it's for a not-profit, then not-for-profit, then unpaid work is, like, it's something I'm really happy to do. I mean, I'm unpaid here now, and I'm really happy to do it because neither of you are getting anything other than, you know, skills and all that kind of thing. Whereas, I actually didn't do a great deal of unpaid work for a for-profit. So I did a lot of volunteering at stuff. I directed the National Young Writers Festival, and that's a not-for-profit. You know, it's an arts organisation. I rarely kind of wrote anything for a for-profit website that, you know, that I didn't get paid for. So that's how I balance it in my mind.
You're working for The Age right now as the arts and entertainment editor?
No, I'm actually now the small business editor. I just changed this week.
Yeah, actually, you told me about that.
Yes.
What's that like, that change in role?
Yeah, so it's been really hard because I'm not that well-versed necessarily in the intricacies of financing small businesses and all that kind of thing. But on the other hand, it's really good for me, I think, to do a stint in business and to be an all-rounder in the industry and have a really wide-ranging knowledge. I can now say, you know, I did general, you know, when I was working in radio, that was out in Ballarat and ABC, that was general news, and I've done arts and entertainment, and now that I'm doing business, I think it's really good for me to develop that rigor as well. Yeah.
Because I was, like, looking up at some of your articles you're writing about, I think, Hamilton.
Yeah.
Hamilton coming to Australia, yes. Which is awesome. Things of that nature. And then you're switching to business.
Mm.
Was that daunting?
Yeah, I don't think it necessarily daunting in so much as I know that I have lots of help and that everyone at the Age is really, really generous. But I am sad to stop writing about, you know, to leave that behind because I love arts and entertainment. It's a real passion of mine. But on the other hand, now I can just enjoy it for what it is rather than worry about having to write about it. So there's, you know, good and bad and everything.
Right. So when you talk about, you know, doing this as a work, you know, doing art as a work versus doing something as a leisurely kind of occupation, how does that differ when you're doing it as a job versus doing it as a kind of passion, leisurely pursuit?
I guess when you're a journalist, you're kind of always switched on. And when you're an entertainment journalist, that means that whenever you're watching any, whenever you're consuming any entertainment or reading any entertainment media, then you're automatically thinking about work. Whereas now, I mean, I'll probably still do it to some degree, but now I don't have any pressure to constantly come up with ideas for entertainment. So I'll just be able to watch TV and not think about angles, which is nice.
And so speaking of, you know, the projects that you're doing, what do you feel is most challenging, like, in your career? I know the small business is something you're not comfortable with, but is that, would you say that's your most challenging, or has there been another another challenging?
Yeah, well, I mean, I did that classic thing, moving to regional to a regional area to pursue my career. So I moved to Ballarat and did casual radio producing there. So I didn't even have a full-time job. And that was... And I was balancing that against another job in Melbourne, so I was commuting and, you know, moving to somewhere new and trying to figure out what matters to people there and developing contacts in a new town. That's hard. You know, you can't just, like, get on Twitter and figure out who's who in a regional town. I mean, it's a city. It's a city, and it's an amazing place. I really loved it in the end, but it did take a while to kind of warm up in that role as well.
What's it like having to move from, say, home, which is Melbourne, to this new place, regional, away from home, hours from, say, like, I guess, from where you're comfortable, and also it's your first job, like, paid full-time job, right?
Mm. It was my first journalism job, yeah. First, like, yeah, proper journalism job. I was really proud of myself. Like, it was hard work, but I loved it. I was a mornings producer for ABC Ballarat with Steve Martin, and I just I felt like I was doing, you know, that was the classic route that journalists always took, right? They would always go regional and come back, and I felt like I was doing the right thing, and I was, and there was such a sense of camaraderie again with the staff there. I feel like so much of why people stay in journalism and love journalism and want to stay in it is because journalists are fun, you know. Like, my experience is that journalists are some of the smartest, you know, people I know, and they're at the ABC and at Fairfax, I've only had really positive experiences of people being generous with me, yeah.
And I guess with journalism, there's a flair of versatility that you got to have,
because
you've got to be able to cover, like, all kinds of ground.
Right.
And how does that feel, to be versatile? Do you think there's pressure to that? Do you think that's just a personal challenge? Or
I really like it. I mean, before the interview, Ahmed was saying that, like, you know, I've done lots of different things, and so I probably haven't specialised. And that's, like, on one hand, that's not great. But on the other hand, I love that. I love learning new things and meeting lots of new people. And, I felt like actually going to Ballarat, if I had gone to Ballarat and I was just working at a small office, I think it would have been a lot harder for me to integrate into the town. But because I did it through media, I got to know lots and lots of people from that, and I felt like I was much more quickly a part of the community there, yeah.
I guess because you're working for Fairfax right now, and this whole backdrop of Fairfax, hashtag Fair Go Fairfax, and all kind of, like, journalists losing their jobs, and you talk about loving journalists and they're the kind of fun people and all this kind of thing. What's it like seeing colleagues and friends lose their jobs?
I think it's pretty heartbreaking when people who are quite energetic kind of lose energy and lose passion because they're just tired. And then also you're seeing, I think you're seeing a few kind of awesome mid-career, like younger people basically, decide to leave journalism because they see it as a contracting industry. And that's really hard. But on the other hand, what you'll find is the people who stay, people who really, really, really want to stay. And that means that that passion is, you know, still really, you can feel it. You can feel it. I mean, it gets depressing. That's, you know, of course, whenever cuts happen and they kind of loom over you and they take months to roll out, that can be really hard. But, yeah.
Are you ever afraid that, like, maybe you're vulnerable to a job loss in that sense?
Well, no, that's because I'm not on a permanent contract. So I don't, like, I've been on 3 maternity leave contracts in a row at Fairfax. I've never had a permanent job there. And the first one was as deputy arts, the second one was online entertainment, and now I'm small business editor. And I think because I come from a generation where contract work is quite normal, I don't assume anything. I don't assume that I'm going to have a career at Fairfax forever. So, yeah, it's a different, I'm in a different place to a lot of people.
What's that instability like? Because you're always like, when I'm working to the next contract.
Yeah. I think now I'm at a point where I feel like I have so many skills and careers and contacts that if I had to leave journalism, it would be really sad, but I could probably find a job outside journalism. And also, I feel like, you know, there are still some exciting opportunities within journalism in Australia that I'd love to take on if I had to leave Fairfax. But I'm really happy and I want to stay.
You know, one of the things that really struck me when I first met Hannah Donnelly, and she's the founder of Indigenous Tracks, well, she told me, oh, she didn't just tell me, she told a bunch of people. It was at a talk. She mentioned that she saw the future as utopian, and while many people saw the future as dystopian. And I guess following that trail of thought, do you see a journalist utopia in the future? Like, I know a lot of people have a lot of, you know, how do you say, like, you know,
negativity, I guess?
Negative thoughts about the future of journalism, you know, and people not valuing journalist labor. But I wanted to know what you felt about the future.
But I mean, that's what's happening to all labor, because all industries are seeing a digital disruption, right? Like taxi drivers have Uber, and, you know, the manufacturing industry is losing to online shopping, and there are changes to the economy everywhere. Mining is seeing a downturn. But then on the other hand, there are people who always find a way to do what they want and to take other people with them, and, like, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats, you know, to grow what they think is important. I know what all the struggles are. Like, so many of my peers live that, you know, I'm just at the start of my career and I've never had a permanent contract. But on the other hand, I think we're in a golden age of investigative journalism at Fairfax. I think, you know, if you look back, people like Adele Ferguson and Nick McKenzie and Richard Baker are producing some of the best journalism in the world, and that has real life impacts. I mean, you know, if you look at the 7-Eleven story, like, that's genuinely inspiring. In my new job, I'm in the business section, so I'm with, you know, I sit near the likes of Adele, and it's so inspiring. So I still see journalism as having an incredible role, and it'll change, and maybe it'll get smaller, but I have, or maybe it'll get bigger. You never really know how these things are going to pan out. I'm really optimistic.
You talk about investigative journalism there, and you're editing at the moment, and you've been editing in a number of your other jobs at Fairfax. Do you want to report?
I do report. Yeah, I do report.
You do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what do you mean by report?
I mean, more in investigative journalism style reporting, like stuff that's happening at Fairfax, which is really interesting, with the multimedia stuff that Adele Ferguson's doing, with 7-Eleven stuff, with the Commonwealth Bank stuff. Mm-hmm. That sort of, are you interested in that sort of thing?
I'm just interested at the moment in getting as much experience as I can. I feel like there aren't many Adeles in the world. There aren't many Nick McKenzies in the world. And, you know, I'm really happy to just be given the opportunity to write what I can. And it's not just them who do investigative reporting. I mean, everyone in Fairfax writes in-depth stories at different points in the week or the month. And even in arts, I did some investigative stuff when I was in arts. We exposed the Kylie Minogue wasn't paying her dancers. I also did a federal government story about, arts funding and how, you know, kind of a bit of corruption in that sense. So it's not always top line, but, we do develop those skills, and I've been really lucky to do that for Lo.
Also, You're one of the few, we're talking off air, you're one of the few, I guess, non-white, people of colour,
mm-hmm.
in, I guess, editing roles, writing roles, at a pretty decent level in journalism.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, how does that make you feel?
I'm proud and grateful, and I'm really proud of my own endeavour, but you don't really get anywhere on your own, and I'm very grateful to the... It's mainly been women in my networks who have lifted me up, and my family who, you know, supported me and helped me and, you know, supported me through high school, and then who have always encouraged me. So, I just think about other people, and I think also... Whenever I meet an uncle in our community who has read my articles or heard me on the radio, that always makes me really proud and makes me feel like, even though every day is not easy, that it's worth doing, because people in our community do see, like, themselves reflected back when they see a Tamil name in the newspaper.
How important is that representation to you?
I feel like, you know, we just need so many more journalists of colour in Australia. I think it's kind of it just gets forgotten because the industry is shrinking and things are getting harder, right? But so the change is slow, but it shouldn't get forgotten. I'm just about to go to a Women in Media event, but the emphasis on people of colour in media in Australia is so much less. And I think that's a real shame. It's, you know, it's very important to me because I don't want to be the only brown person in any particular room that I walk in.
I guess, what's it like being the only brown person in a particular room? Because I know how it feels to be the only black person in newsrooms, like not necessarily newsrooms, but in university journalism newsrooms,
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we have lots of like wonderful writers of colour at Fairfax. Nassim Kadem is the deputy business editor. She's Persian. Jane Lee in Canberra. We've got... Sushi Dash, who I mentioned, is a comment. And obviously The Age kind of gave Waleed Ali his first start writing columns. That was Sushi as well. So, you know, we do have, you know, I do feel like Dewi Cook, who's the deputy arts editor now, we do have women of colour in amazing roles at Fairfax, but there just needs to be so much more. And, you know, it's interesting because I think it's, like, if you look at the business community compared to, like, the business, you know, white collar, just general, like, banks or whatever, you'll see so many more people of colour than you will in a newsroom. And that...
Why do you think that is?
Look, I think a lot of people would probably see it as not a viable career, as we've been talking about today. I mean, a lot of, you know, migrants might not see it as a bankable way to live. You don't see that many people of colour in the courses to start with, right? But then, you know, there's the attrition rate, like you get to uni and then after that getting a job, like it's so hard already. I think it's a shame because there's a feedback loop where if you don't see, people who represent, you know, you or who represent diverse communities in the media, then you don't think that it's possible, right? So it's a feedback loop that young people in 9 or 10 will just be like, well, that's not really for me.
Then how did you get into that role that you are now? Because you obviously there wasn't a Tamil person at the Fairfax, at like when you were younger, or at the Herald Sun, or any kind of like media organization, and you broke through.
I mean, there was Indira Naidu. I feel like for me though, I didn't necessarily look up to any one person, but it was just. I would see the white presenters who I really admired, and there are so, you know, who I admired for their craft, and I was like, well, I could do that. I guess that's. And then also, I saw overseas, you see so many people of color succeeding in the media, and that inspires you as well, right? Yeah.
So when you're talking about Australian media, there's not a lot of people of color. How does that translate to news reporting or the kinds of stories you see? Does the lack of, you know, how do we say it? Does the lack of diversity reflect, you know, cultural insensitivity or even just misrepresentation of stories involving people of color? Does that translate that way?
Yeah, I think if you had more people of color, you would have better stories about diverse communities. I don't think that, like, I think that's quite obvious. On the other hand, I think sometimes there's also just bad reporting. Like, so there's bad reporting in all areas of journalism, and it happens. We all see it everywhere. It does happen. It's unfortunate that it happens, but when you belong to a minority and then you see that bad reporting happening on top of all the other injustices that might happen to your minority, that's when it feels particularly hard, I think. Yeah,
and I think something that really struck me was like a few years ago when someone had misreported that this is an ISIS flag, when it's actually not an ISIS flag. During the siege, it was actually a Shahada flag. And so it's small things like that, you know, as someone who's Muslim, someone who can read Arabic, for me, I can easily look at the iconography and realize it's wrong. But because maybe the newsroom is not diverse or they're just not knowledgeable,
right,
they clearly did not see the nuances.
But to me, that's just like, If there was an Arabic person in the newsroom, they could have easily fact-checked that, right?
And yeah. Because I know your foreign editor is Mahir?
Mahir Mograbi, yeah.
And I know that what he did.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When the Sydney siege was happening, he got the ISIS flag, the Shahada flag, and a number of different like Arabic iconography, and like showed this is that. And then it ended up being on, I think, Fairfax's newspaper the following day as like a spread. So like, is that, I guess, the importance of diversity?
Yeah, absolutely. And Maher's a great example of that. He knows everything about the Middle East, and he speaks several languages, so knowledgeable and so well connected to Palestinian community. He's well connected to lots of Muslim communities in Melbourne. So he understands those issues and he knows how important it is to get it right. That's why he's a world editor. Yeah. He's fantastic at his job, and we're really lucky to have him. I'm so glad we did that, you know. I think in particular TV stations, the commercial TV stations, you'll see fewer non-white faces. And that's, you know, those commercial TV stations are less likely to take risks, but they're also the ones that cover these breaking news stories increasingly about terrorism the fastest, and they have to have rolling coverage. So you can see then when those two issues collide.
And I guess, like, particularly we see the outcry when someone like Walid Ali gets into, I guess, a role like that, and the public outcry. We see people unhappy with the logies and et cetera. I guess, what do you think that says?
Look, I think it's important to focus on the fact that actually the project is doing better with Walid, and people love him, and the reason he's been nominated for a logie is because millions of people watched his video about ISIS last year. So I think what we're hearing is that people love Waleed. I think there is a certain section of society and a certain establishment who are threatened by the shifts, by the fact that someone like him who hasn't come up through TV, who's come from academia, has come through sideways, can still be really successful, and that threatens the whole model of how do you become a TV star, right? So people that are working towards being a TV star through acting or TV presenting, the bosses of those commercial TV worlds, they're confused and, you know, they're being left behind in this new world. So I think that's what you see. I think that's what fear often is just like, or hate often is just like that fear of like what's going on right now.
Thanks for coming on the podcast, Bhakti. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And I guess before we go, can you let our listeners know where they can, I guess, find your stuff or follow you on social media and stuff like that?
Yeah, my Twitter handle is at Bhakti, so that's Bhakthi. And if you just search that name, because there's only one Bhakti at The Age, if you just search that name in attheage.com.au, then you'll see all my stories.
Thank you again for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Tony Abbott was really never a deeply popular figure among the electorate.
Tony Abbott faced some hostility of his own.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Dig it.
Oh, really?
And really the reason why his prime ministership has crumbled is because he lost the support of the electorate and ultimately the governing Liberal Party.
This is not an easy day for many people in this building. Leadership changes are never easy for our country.
The prime minister's not going to lose, he's going to win. The prime minister's not going to lose, he's going to win.
My pledge today is to make this change as easy as I can.
Goodbye, Tony. Bye-bye. Goodbye, Tony. Tony, time to go. Goodbye. Roll over. Knock and talk into bed. Bye-bye, Tony.
We're now taking our trash out into the bin. We'll be highlighting some of the news stories that need to be thrown in there for the past week.
Yeah, and I don't know about you. Obviously, everyone's been reacting to Lemonade, and we have two stories that are kind of linked to Beyonce's Lemonade. One from the Sydney Morning Herald, a journalist called Jenna Clark. I think her name is. Let me just have a look. Yep, Jenna Clark. She wrote in an article that she wrote. She said, "So referencing Lemonade. So what if an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander artist did the same thing? What if instead of songs like Pop a Bottle, Fill Me Up, Jessica Mulboy chronicled her experiences as a woman of the Kuku Yalaningi people through her performance?" And I'm like, sure, you know, that would be great if Jessica Mulboy felt like she should do that. But just because she's not doesn't mean or should take away from her music or whatever she's doing. And there are tons of Indigenous people across Australia that do very, really cool political music. So why don't you talk about them instead of trying to go, Jessica Mulboy, I want you to do this. And it's funny because it comes from this woman that's not from the community, that has not, I don't think this person's ever met Jessica Mulboy as well. So it's kind of odd coming from someone who doesn't even know her, never seen her, probably never spoken to her, say, hey, you should do this kind of music.
And it's so condescending, I think, to make that statement that, hey, you're doing the wrong kind of music, you should do this kind of music. And it's weird because there was this incident where Jessica Mulboy actually couldn't perform because of anxiety. And people were being so harsh on her. And she did what she felt was right at the time. And perhaps maybe now she is just not at the point where she wants to make that kind of music. And still people are expecting so much of her. It's almost like Jessica Mulboy can't be. Like, yeah. She always has to be told what to do, what not to do.
Yeah, and if Jessica Mulboy wasn't Indigenous, if she was just a white artist, no one would be saying, you should be talking about whiteness a lot. You know, like, talk to us about, you know, all these subjects that would not apply to someone who wasn't Indigenous or who wasn't a person of colour, trying to say, Beyonce is doing this, therefore you should do that. So, Jenna Clark, I just think that article and that whole premise should be going into a special place. It's called the bin.
And so following one of the terrible think pieces that have come about because of Lemonade, alongside Piers Morgan, I don't know if you heard of Piers Morgan.
Yeah, I've heard of Piers Morgan. He's an Arsenal supporter and he's a horrible human being as well.
There's a long history of being horrible. So The Guardian decided to find its own Piers Morgan, and they apparently found Elle Hunt, which is, I think, the Australian version of Piers Morgan. But anyway, so she wrote a think piece on how to explaining what Lemonade was from beginner to Bayhive, as she calls it. And I just feel like, look, this is like peak white splainy. This is like the worst thing you can do right now. And especially like The Guardian doing something like that when The Guardian UK had someone like Ijeoma who wrote an incredible piece in response to Lemonade, which is written by a black woman. I think that was just weird that they didn't just share that and maybe commission that article to an actual black woman or a black femme. And on top of that, the interesting thing that I noticed is that Iggy Azalea, getting her name wrong.
Who cares about her? Oh, he's talking about Iggy Azalea.
She made those comments saying like Becky was a slur. And I just feel like she is one, white, and two, Australian. And the least maybe that someone like Elle Hunt could have done is maybe comment on that. That's where it matters. That's where you gotta like talk about stuff. And they didn't. They completely missed it. And that's just, you know, a national embarrassment continuing to proliferate. And that needs to go into the bin.
And also, I just found the other day I was on Twitter, and I was reading Chris Hayes' Twitter. I'm gonna find this right now. Hold on.
And you know what's really funny is that
This is just really funny. All right, so Chris Hayes and his 4-year-old. This is a story about Chris Hayes and his 4-year-old. Chris Hayes is anchor on NBC. So he says, "Today, my 4-year-old and I rode the elevator with Iggy Azalea. # take your kid to work day." And then he goes, "And we were all pretty shocked when my daughter looked up at Iggy and said, 'Keep Beyonce's name out of your mouth.'" That was just...
I saw that. I loved it. I think I liked it. I loved it. Sorry. Now you can have like reactions on Facebook. I forgot. And you know, the funny thing is like all these people are having conversations now, you know, about Becky, who is Becky with the good hair, and Iggy coming and saying like Becky's a slur, but like no one says anything about the good hair part. And that for me is like a little bit weird, but it's also something that a lot of black women and a lot of black femmes have pointed out.
I'm banning all rap this year at the awards. Yeah, don't get me wrong, I love hip-hop, obviously. But tonight, it's all about soul. Okay, hold on a second. I got another call, wait a minute. Oh, Thugger! What's up, Young Thug? No, honestly, man, you are my favorite artist out right now. But I ain't letting anybody in with no littles and youngs and their name. Yeah. Hang on one second. I'm sorry, y'all. Yes. Who is this? Iggy Azalea. Yeah, hey. Oh, no, you can come, because what you're doing is definitely not rap. Yeah. Yeah, I got on my overalls. Yeah. In fact, I'm going to send an Uber for you right now. Yeah, come on, be outside.
This week we've been talking about homelessness and the housing crisis, and Amina Ziad has the story for us.
On any given night, 1 in 200 people across Australia experience homelessness. For every 10,000 people in the state of Victoria, about 43 people experience homelessness. However, the government's response to homelessness is to further privatize housing, decreasing the numbers of available public housing and increasing an already lengthy waiting list of approximately 10 to 20 years. A group of people, however, have taken action against homelessness. Members of the Homeless Persons Union Victoria
occupied a vacant house on 2 Bendigo Street as a public protest to raise awareness of the housing and homelessness crisis. I spoke to Spike from the Homeless Persons Union Victoria to find out more.
Yeah, this is about, this occupation is about drawing attention to the housing crisis in Victoria and the fact that public housing is being privatised through community or social housing, which is, there's a big difference. Difference being that social or community housing is can be owned by the government, but not always. You can be forced to pay over 30% of your income in rent. They cherry pick their tenants who are the most functional. Their rights, for example, if they lose their job, their rent doesn't go up and down just like in public housing. It's fixed. It's a fixed sort of rate. That community and social housing is subsidised, is corporate. People get rent assistance to live in social and public housing, so then we're basically the taxpayers subsidising the corporatisation of housing, of public housing. And so that is another reason why we got involved, is because we believe that public housing should be a universal human right in this country.
There is a reason for deliberately grouping public and community housing together under social housing. The confusion makes the discourse hard to follow, and maybe that's what those in power want in order to maintain the status quo. Some are overrepresented in these demographic statistics. Australia's Indigenous population make up about 3% of the total population, yet account for almost 30% for those experiencing homelessness. Queer youth are 4 times likely to experience homelessness than their cis heteronormative counterparts due to family rejection. Almost half of the homeless population are women, many escaping domestic violence and abuse. I spoke to Spike, who mentions a little more about who are amongst the homeless and how they came to be homeless.
Because they've been denied access to housing, long-term housing. It should be a universal right, just like Medicare, healthcare is. Why not housing? I don't think that's controversial, actually. And I don't think anyone here thinks it's controversial either. I think it's controversial for the people in power because they don't want to be seen to be rewarding what they see as dysfunctional behaviour. These people don't work, they're lazy, they've got drug problems, they drink too much. Well, there's a, when you're a 10 or 12 year old, your ambition isn't to be to sleep under a tree. What's happened to people over that time for them to lose all their dreams, their ambitions, their goals, their self-worth? Domestic violence, abuse, sexual assault, gambling, drinking problems. These all happen within the home. They keep talking about family values and the family being the cornerstone. Conservatives talk a lot about how important the family is. But the family is also the site of some of the greatest battles that where people are brutalised.
And it's not just privatisation, property investment and speculation. Gentrification is another contributing factor, pushing new migrants out and fracturing societies.
You mentioned before that your parents were immigrants from Italy.
Yeah.
And also, I've been thinking about this for a while, and I'm not too sure how relevant it is. But say, like, gentrified neighbourhoods, or neighbourhoods being gentrified, like Footscray, where there's lots of migrants, low-income households. With the gentrification, is that increasing the risk of homelessness or pushing people towards homelessness?
Because, again, if we talk about community, these families are being pushed out onto the perimeters of the city. So workers are forced further and further out away from where they work, from the communities that they lived in, like their family links, like extended family, like uncles, brothers, sisters, they all can't move together. For example, when my parents, I was born in Richmond. As the family got bigger and they started closing down the factories, my parents moved out to Thomastown and I lost contact with my cousins, my aunt. So the community was broken down. All the supports that I grew up with up until I was 5 disappeared. And so you're left as just this single family unit to deal with the world, the world as it is. And you struggle because, you know, people do need community. The people, someone who they know that they trust that they can speak to. There's also a lot of racism in this country. The difficulties that people face when they've been moved out of somewhere where they feel comfortable, like if they've come from overseas and they've done the hard yards and made somewhere home in Footscray. See, Richmond's been gentrified, Carlton's been gentrified, Fitzroy is just about gentrified, Mount Brunswick Street. Collingwood is next. Carlton has been gentrified. So all these working families that used to live there have been forced out into the perimeters of the city, where some of them a lot of people are living by themselves, away from their families and away from, shops that they knew, neighbourhoods that they knew, and people that, from different backgrounds they developed relationships with. So, yeah, definitely gentrification is part of that.
During the course of the Bendigo Street occupation, they've made allies. One in particular is activist Javed, who says gentrification is not about people's needs, but rather about investment.
The drivers behind gentrification being based in, especially in property speculation and investment, those are things that tend to push, a housing market that's not about people's needs, but it's about investment and about profit and about wealth accumulation. People do get displaced. I've seen people displaced by gentrification.
And there's more. Homelessness and social stigma of and structural spite for homelessness drives a cycle of imprisonment. Spike tells me how the day-to-day survival becomes incriminating.
Because if we continue to sit on our hands just like they have, people are going to be forced in. They're going to be forced into doing. They're going to be criminalised, or maybe the housing. They see that the people in power see that the solution to the housing problem is prison, because that's where people are going to end up. For drinking in public, urinating in public, or defecating in public. But if the toilets are closed, you get busted two or three times defecating and urinating in public, or maybe four times, or for trespass because you wanted to find some shelter, you end up in prison. So is that what the answer to homelessness is, the prison system?
Is that happening now?
Oh, definitely. Look, I've spoken to people that say, winter's coming, I think I might get locked up. And for some people, that's the only thing they know.
So what drives people to occupy spaces like Bendigo Street? Java tells us his story.
There was a group of four women, homeless women, who were squatting one of these houses, and this strip of houses, and along with up to 120, we don't know, other houses were acquired for building the East West Link, and then when that project was abandoned, there were commitments made about a lot of these houses being handed over. Those were the words used for the use to address the issue of homelessness in Melbourne. And a lot of them, some of them have been, but this particular strip seems to have been vacant for quite a long time. So these four women took it upon themselves to inhabit one of these houses, and they were squatting there for a while, and were eventually moved by the police on the authority of the Department of, this kind of a mouthful of a department called the Department of Economics, Jobs, Transport and Roads, and probably something else, who, despite saying at the time that they would find them alternative housing arrangements, didn't, and effectively took these four women who were otherwise homeless out of a comfortable house, and took them back out onto threw them back out onto the street, essentially.
But how many empty houses are there, and what's being done for people experiencing homelessness in Victoria?
There's 25,000 homeless people in Victoria, more than 30,000 people on waiting lists for public housing, that are 20 years long, you know, people, you know, who are like even the people that the state recognizes to have those urgent needs for housing, you know, they say, the state says, you know, you have to wait 20 years. And the, also the fact that there's 80,000 empty houses in Melbourne, which is something that, you know, that bodies which represent property investors and developers, you know, really clamoring to deny these statistics, but they're based on water usage. Like they're arguing that these properties are being used when they're just not using any water. And I think that's actually a very reliable metric of whether these properties are being used or not. So I think, yeah, the idea that there's a shortage of supply, which is the idea that's most often thrown around as a explanation of why there's a housing crisis. You know, people say that it's because we don't have enough housing, but there are 80,000 empty houses in Melbourne. Like, that's a shockingly large amount. And they're in places that people want to live. Like, 20% of Docklands is vacant.
Often people isolate homeless people from the wider community and view homelessness as a choice rather than a structural issue.
This is something that affects a lot of people. I mean, it seems like housing is about, you know, lifestyle or something like that, but housing is connected to so many things about people's health, whether they're able to find, you know, stability in their lives, whether they're able to escape violence, if they, you know, like that was like, I think as the recent report of the Royal Commission into Family Violence found, that housing is a real, you know, a real input into some of these kinds of violence. And I think, you know, being aware that, you know, housing is not an isolated issue of just where you get to live and how nice your house is, and that's how people tend to reduce it, but it's actually something that's really basic to the kind of safety and flourishing of everybody.
But at the end of the day, there's one thing Spike wants others to know about homeless people.
Don't just look at them as people that are homeless. They're people first. They're people that have the same needs, wants, desires, hopes, dreams as everyone else, that they've been forced to forget those to meet their, in the battle to meet their basic needs on a daily basis. Whether it be food, access to a toilet, a shower, somewhere to lie down, somewhere to have a cup of coffee, somewhere where they can look in a mirror. These are things that people take for granted. It's just like, begin to think, how would it be if you wake up and there's no alarm clock, but it was the traffic that woke you up? How can we expect these people to function in a working environment under those sort of circumstances? I suggest that people think about public policy and the way it's impacting people. And I think about shit. You know, and they say that everyone's three paychecks from being homeless. That if you don't work for 3 weeks, you end up on the street. That's one of the sayings within the homeless sector. So I would suggest that people think about that, think about what it means to have a common humanity, because that's all we have.
Thanks, Amina, for that story. That was Amina Ziad's story on housing and homeless people and the crisis that's inflicting a lot of Victorians at the moment. And I guess that's our show for this week. Thanks for everyone that's been listening. And before we do leave you and your earbuds, I guess, remember, you can subscribe on Acast and iTunes. Maybe leave us a rating. Someone recently left us a rating and I really enjoyed it. Leave us another rating and hopefully. And also you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/racecardshow. You can find us on Twitter at racecardpod. You can find you, Amina, where can they find you?
They can find me on Twitter at Amina Ziard, AmenaZiard.
Awesome. And you can find me at Ahmed Yusuf 10, the number 10. You can find us on Tumblr as well, racecardpodcast.tumblr.com, and our website, racecardpodcast.com. And that's me saying goodbye.
Thank you for listening. You're such a great audience.
Yeah. Bye. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Yeah, that's much better actually. Alright, let's start!
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.